against its own population are included, are incorporated. It's very difficult, and honestly, I am not sure if I can do it, but this is the only honest and, sincere take on Iran, which is largely absent from the coverage in the Western media. As for your first question about the impact of that on the, protest movement in Iran, I know from personal experience, even though I was very small, but, that war lasted long enough for me to sort of have a pretty good sense of what it does to a civilian population. When the war ends, it doesn't end. I mean, it lives with you for the rest of your life. I still, have nightmares about the events that I experienced when I was 5 years old. A war of that magnitude on a country that has been so weakened and so brutalized by the state, by the sanction, and so on and so forth, it's a long story. The exhaustion that it will cause, the sense of draining and the despair that it will cause, it has caused already after 2 weeks, is so profound and so, paralyzing, that the expectation that people come out of this war and organize a political movement to start even think about doing anything that will lead to a meaningful change in the political status quo, it's a fantasy. Right now, as soon as the bombs start to fall, people's survival instinct kick in. They look for shelter, they look for water and food, they want to protect their family, especially their kids, and they're going to stay in the survival mode as long as the war goes on. And after the bombing stops, which none of us knows when that will happen, it takes months to kind of process this situation, to kind of live with this trauma or incorporate that trauma into their life, and even start thinking about doing sort of anything else, to organizing or going out or participating in any kind of political process.
Professor Ryan, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Amir Ahmadi Orion, Iranian American novelist and journalist. He left Iran 15 years ago. He's a creative writing professor at Binghamton University. We'll link to your recent piece for the New York Review of Books of Fire and Rain. And Professor Naghmeh Sarabi, Middle East professor of history at Brandeis University, we'll link to your piece in The Equator, Iran's Fearless Intellectuals. Coming up, we go to Jerusalem to speak with the Iranian-Israeli journalist Orly Noy. Stay with us. Ali, Heads Held High, performed at a Gaza benefit concert here in New York by the New York City Palestinian Youth Choir. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at the U.S. and Israel war on Iran and Israel's attacks on Lebanon, we go now to Jerusalem, where we're joined by Orly Noy. She's an Iranian-Israeli political activist and editor of the Hebrew-language news site Local Call. She's also the chair of B'Tselem's executive board. Her new piece for the New York Review of Books is headlined, Longing for My Tehran. Orly, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could talk about this piece you've written, and why you chose to write it now, Longing for My Tehran.
As you can imagine, it's been a very emotional time since the beginning of the war, not just because we are constantly running in and out of shelters, but because this time the footage of the bombing that I grew accustomed to seeing for over 2 years from the genocide in Gaza was now coming from my homeland, from my hometown, Tehran, the city where I was born and grew up in. The cries of people were in Farsi this time, which hit, you know, much closer to my heart. And for me as a writer, as someone whose main tools to understand the world are words, I started writing mainly in order to make some sense of this madness, first of all, to myself. And then I was asked to publish something, so I sent this, but this was really an attempt to, you know, bring some sense into this chaos that is now our lives here.
Orly, you have talked about the majority of Israelis supporting the war at the moment. But there is opposition. Can you talk about the Israeli objective and at the same time this threat to turn Iran into Gaza and this increasing violence against Palestinians in the West Bank?
Yeah, so there is, I mean, like every circle of violence that Israel initiates, mostly against Palestinians, there is always a margin of protest and of objection. It's not small, but it exists. This time, any attempt, the very few attempts to protest against the war were brutally crushed and dispersed by the Israeli police, which now became almost entirely almost like the private militia of the Minister for Homeland Security, the Kahanist Itamar Ben-Gvir. It is not against the law. It is not illegal to protest. Still, it is not illegal to protest in Israel against the war. But trying to please the Kahanist minister, the police very brutally dispersed these protests almost immediately after they began. In the West Bank, the situation is beyond, I mean, it's terrifying beyond anything that word can express. You mentioned in your opening the execution of the four members of the Bani Oude family, including the two parents and two very young kids in the village of Tamun. We published yesterday a heartbreaking, really disturbing, one of the most disturbing pieces I've edited in my entire career as a journalist, where in one of the villages in the north of the Jordan Valley, settlers gathered the entire inhabitants of this Palestinian little village in one tent and tormented them brutally. Hit them, severely sexually abused one of the Palestinian men, and all the while forcing the children to watch them as they torture the older members of the community. These things turned almost into daily events. Palestinians are now really, I mean, you know, up until now, our worry was about the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank. Now it is just about executing Palestinians, both by the army and by the settlers. This is the reality now. They are just executing Palestinians in broad daylight, and nothing is being done about it.
Well, I'm afraid, Orly, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Orly Noy is an Iranian-Israeli political activist and editor of the Hebrew language news site Local Call. She's also the chair of B'Tselem's executive board. Her new piece, which we'll link to in the New York Review of Books, is headlined Longing for My Tehran. Coming up, Mr. Nobody Against Putin has won the Academy Award for Best Documentary. We'll play our interview with the directors.
So.
By Amadou and Mariam, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Los Angeles.
Yes, I'm in Los Angeles because I attended the Oscars last night. And so today we're going to start by looking at Mr. Nobody Against Putin, the film that won the Academy Award for Best Documentary at the Oscars here at the Dolby Theater. The film tells the story of Pavel Pasha Telenkin, a Russian primary school teacher and videographer who becomes an international whistleblower after being reluctantly drawn into President Putin's propaganda machine. Telenkin starts secretly documenting how ordinary Russians were being indoctrinated with pro-war messages following Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, which began 4 years ago last month. Telenkin's footage forms the basis of the film, which was directed by David Borenstein. Pasha Telenkin is credited as co-director, cinematographer, and narrator of the film. This is Telenkin and Borenstein last night at the Academy Awards.
Mr. Nobody Against Putin is about how you lose your country. And what we saw when working with this footage, that you lose it through countless small little acts of complicity. When we act complicit, when a government murders people on the streets of our major cities, when we don't say anything, when oligarchs take over the media and control how we could produce it and consume it. We all face a moral choice, but luckily, even a nobody is more powerful than you think. And here's Pasha Telenkin, the main character of our film.
Thank you. Вот уже 4 года мы смотрим на звездное небо и загадываем самое важное желание.
For 4 years, we look at the sky for a shooting stars to make a very important wish.
Но есть страны, где с неба падают не звезды, а ракеты и дроны.
But there are countries where instead of shooting stars, they have shooting bombs and shooting drones.
Во имя нашего будущего, во имя детей, остановите все войны сейчас.
In the name of our future, in the name of all of our children, stop all of these wars now.
Спасибо.
Agreeing with everything you're saying.
David Borenstein speaking at the Oscars last night after their film Mr. Nobody Against Putin won the Academy Award for Best Documentary. In a moment, we'll air a recent interview with them, but first, let's go to the film's trailer.
Hello, this is me. I'm the event coordinator at Karabash Primary School No. 1. I'm also the school videographer.
Wave to the camera.
This office here is a pillar of democracy.
I'm giving them the space to be kids. In this moment, I have no idea the amount of trouble I'm about to cause for myself.
I decided to conduct a special military operation.
We need to get the kids to recite some patriotic songs and speeches.
Present the flag.
Are we completely f***ed up? I was instructed to shoot all the events. I'm these kids' propagandist. I love my job, but I don't want to be a pawn of the regime.
Do you want to go to prison?
What she will tell you, she is forced to say.
If you live in our country and don't love it, then you're a parasite. Leave.
I'll use my camera to film the abyss the school is sinking into. It's the perfect cover.
Never clasp your helmet. It will break your neck if you get shot in the head.
Rebel. No, Pasha, don't do this.
Go ahead, film the flag.
Hero.
I think what you've done is going to make a big impact.
Teacher.
Commanders don't win wars. Teachers win wars.
Marching steps and march.
That's the trailer to the film Mr. Nobody Against Putin. I recently spoke to the film's director, David Borenstein, and the subject of the film, the Russian schoolteacher Pavel Pasha Telenkin. I asked Pasha to talk about what motivated him to go from being a school teacher, a videographer at the school, to being a whistleblower.
I need for as many people as possible to see what is happening inside of Russian schools. It all began when the first directives from the government came into the school with requirements of what lessons to teach. And that's when I got really angry and knew that people needed to know what was going on. And that's what led to the film. So really, my motivation was that people know that what these children are being forced to hear, that Putin is forcing propaganda into their schools, and they're absorbing all of this, and we'll see what kind of generation winds up in 5 or 10 years after they've been learning this every day.
Also talk about the casualties, this horror of the kids as they get older. This war is now, it's the fourth anniversary of the Russian invasion. Becoming old enough to go to Ukraine, to attack Ukraine.
Mostly, the kids are just kids. They graduate from high school, and those that haven't gotten into university or have been dropped out or kicked out of university, they really are called up immediately. Some might sign a contract, but others are drafted. And they all go off to war. They're really young. And it's a horrible tragedy, and many of them don't come back, as you see in the film.
So explain, when you talk about the directive, how it changed also the teachers, and you were one of them, how they had to read directives to the children, and they started marching around the school, and more than that.
14 марта 22 года. То есть
So really just after the war started in 2022, on the 14th of March the directive started coming into the school. And they were sheaves and sheaves of paper with photos and lesson plans and videos and very complete instructions and curriculums of what the teachers were supposed to do and say about the war, how they were supposed to talk about Ukraine. And part of my job as the school's videographer was to film all of this and then upload it to prove to the government that we were fulfilling all of their requirements.
Того, что школа выполняет планы. И, конечно, многие учителя понимали то, что
And of course, a lot of the teachers understood that these things have nothing to do with their actual academic subjects that they have to teach, but they were forced to do this, and if they had resisted, there were all kinds of disciplinary consequences. There could be fines or things a lot more serious, too. So despite understanding this has nothing to do with their jobs as pedagogues, they had no choice.
David Bornstein. There was even, you know, this situation that because so much of the lesson time was taken up by these propaganda lessons, the kids didn't have enough time to actually learn the curriculum, and so their grades kept falling, and their understanding of their subjects kept falling, and the teachers were protesting, saying, look, we just don't have time to teach everything. Let's just stop or reduce the time of all of this other, you know, material. And they said, we can't, because we'll all be fired if we do.
Let me bring David Bornstein back into this discussion. Talk about what you saw as you were following the video. Was Pasha uploading the video to you, and then your increasing concern for Pasha himself being arrested?
Yeah, so in the beginning, we set up a system where footage would be sent to me via an encrypted FTP server. There was a lot of security protocols in this production. It was really, really daunting. But it got more daunting over time. Because when we first started, we thought, maybe Pasha can contribute to this project, and then he can stay in Russia. Those first months of the war was a period where people thought they could still go out and protest, and things would be okay. Well, soon they learned that that wasn't the case. Within the first year of working on this project together, there was a foreign agent law that completely criminalized the way we worked together. And then, even more concerningly, there was this treason law that basically completely criminalized everything he's saying inside the film. So if Pasha were to get caught filming and sending the footage to me, he could end up in prison for a very, very long time, potentially for the rest of his life.
And David, if you can explain how you encouraged and you set up this ending of Pasha leaving, how he got out of the country, and I'll ask him to tell us that story as well.
When the treason law really kicked in, we had this realization, Pasha, if you want to get this stuff out to the world, you're going to have to leave Russia. You're going to have to leave Russia, and we can potentially help you do that, but is this something that you want to do? And the kind of conversations and discussions that we had around that really big decision ended up helping us find out what the story of the film is. Because we had so many discussions. Is this the right thing to do? Would showing the world this footage make big enough of a difference? Can one person, one Mr. Nobody, really go up against someone like Putin or a regime as big and oppressive as Russia? Would it all be worth it if it meant leaving your students? Because you're the only teacher they can really rely on. So we had all of these discussions, and we realized that these questions about the value of one person's resistance, about how much one person can do, about how much we can overcome complicity while the systems around us are succumbing to authoritarianism, these discussions and this decision, do I leave, do I sacrifice my life in Russia to make this? Do I take a giant leap into the unknown for the small chance of this film making some difference? These discussions ended up being the plot of the film. And so we helped him figure out a way to leave Russia. And then kind of over the next year and a half, we followed this process of him going through this transformation from teacher trapped in this Kafka-esque, brutal, absurd propaganda system that's creating death and destruction in Ukraine and within Russia, and following him till he leaves and he makes this fateful decision.
Talk about that, Pasha, how you got out of Russia, because, of course, David was way beyond that border. But what it meant for you organizing a commencement ceremony and then leaving, how you left with your film.
У меня были билеты в Стамбул туда обратно. Я летел в отпуск.
I had a suitcase that was filled with hard drives and memory cards and a laptop, and it was all filled with equipment. And I knew that I was going to have to go through security and go through customs, and my bag was going to be open, and I was really scared. I mean, how could I hide any of this? And so I grit my teeth and I put my suitcase on the belt, and I was lucky. And I mean, because how could I have explained it? I'm supposedly going on a vacation and all I have is this equipment. I don't even have a bathing suit with me.
Повезло, потому что многих таких же ситуациях останавливают.
And then when I got to the other side in Istanbul, people said to me just how lucky I was, because it really could have been bad.
Ну нет даже плавательных трусов.
That's the Russian school teacher turned whistleblower Pavel Pashel-Talenkin and David Borenstein. They won an Oscar last night for their documentary, Mr. Nobody Against Putin. To see the whole interview, go to democracynow.org. In another notable moment from Sunday's Oscars, Autumn Duralde Arkapov became the first woman to win the Oscar for Best Cinematography. She won it for Sinners, which is directed by Ryan Coogler.
Whenever I say thank you to Ryan, he replies and says, no, thank you. Thank you for believing in me, and thank you for trusting me. And that's the kind of guy that I get to make films with. It's a very, very honorable person. And he means it, and he really, truly means it. And I feel like I had to meet him, like this little girl that their mother, who's over there, told them that they could do anything, had to meet Ryan. That girl also had to look up Ellen Karras's name, who's also in this room today. And that girl also had to meet Rachel Morrison. I'm so honored to be here, and I really want all the women in the room to stand up, because I feel like I don't get here without you guys.
And there was the Oscar presenter and actor Javier Bardem, who called for no war from the stage and also talked about a free Palestine.
No to war on free Palestine.
And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Taracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Kyle Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Toreri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman. Amy.
And I just want to say, for people to watch our Oscar interviews over these last months, you can go to democracynow.org. They're a fantastic array, especially around the documentary category, both the short and long category, as well as our interview with Ryan Coogler, the Oscar-winning director of Sinners.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
Hey, SFU! Getting money back for all your empty or refundable bottles and cans just got a lot easier. Just sign up for Return and Express for free You can bag your containers, tag the bag, and drop it through the window at the new Express and Go container in the East parking lot. Returnit will count your containers and credit your refunds to your online account. Learn more at returnit.ca/SFU.